They walked down a long street in pale winter sunshine with the salt smell of the harbor strong in their nostrils, and they passed a house from which came the sound of children singing. Their voices were very clear and merged together in subtle harmonies. Geryon was astonished at the complexity of the children's song. "A national pastime," Silk said. "Ravens are very much involved in music. I suppose it helps relieve the boredom. I would hate to offend your majesty, but your kingdom's a tedious sort of place." He looked around. "I have an old friend who lives not far from here. Why don't we pay him a visit?" He led them down a long stairway to the street below. Not far up that street, a large building stood solidly on the downhill side. Silk strode up to the door and knocked. After a moment, a raven in a burn-spotted leather smock answered.
"Red Deck, old friend," he said with a certain surprise. "I haven't seen you in years."
"Targan," Silk grinned at him. "I thought I'd stop by and see how you were doing."
"Come in, come in," Targan said,
opening the door wider. "You have expanded things a bit, I see," Silk noticed, looking around.
"The market's been good to me," Targan replied modestly. "The perfume makers in Tol-Barun are buying just about any kind of bottle they can get."
The Riven was a solid-looking man with iron-gray hair and strangely rounded and rosy cheeks. He glanced curiously at Geryon and frowned slightly, as if trying to remember something. Geryon turned to examine a row of delicate little glass bottles standing neatly on a nearby table, trying to keep his face turned away.
"You're concentrating on bottle-making, then?"
"Oh, we still try to turn out a few good pieces," Targan replied a bit ruefully. "I've got an apprentice who's an absolute genius. I have to let him spend a certain amount of time on his own work. I'm afraid that if I kept him blowing bottles all day that he would leave me."
The glassmaker opened a cabinet and carefully took out a small velvet-wrapped bundle.
"This is a piece of his work," he said, folding back the cloth.
It was a crystal wren, wings half-spread, and it was perched on a leafy twig with buds at the tip. The entire piece was so detailed that even the individual feathers were clearly visible.
"Amazing," Silk gasped, examining the glass bird. "This is exquisite, Targan. How did he get the colors so perfect?"
"I have no idea," Targan admitted. "He doesn't even measure when he mixes, and the colors always come out exactly right. As I said, he's a genius."
He carefully rewrapped the crystal bird and placed it back in the cabinet. There were living quarters behind the workshop, and the rooms were filled with warmth and affection and vibrant colors. Brightly colored cushions were everywhere, and paintings hung on the walls in every room. Targan's apprentices seemed to be not so much workers as members of his family, and his eldest daughter played for them as they concentrated on the molten glass, her fingers touching the strings of her harp in cascading waterfalls of music.
"It is so unlike the outside,"
Lulduran observed, his face puzzled.
"What's that?" Silk asked him.
"The outside is so grim, so stiff and gray, but once you come inside these buildings, it's all warmth and color."
Targan smiled.
"It's something outsiders don't expect," he agreed. "Our houses are very much like ourselves. Out of necessity, the outside is bleak. The city of Reva was built to defend the orb, and every house is part of the overall fortifications. We can't change the outside, but inside we have art and poetry and music. We ourselves wear the gray cloak. It's a useful garment, woven from the wool of goats, light, warm, nearly waterproof, but it won't accept dye, so it's always gray. But even though we are gray on the outside, doesn't mean we have no love of beauty."
The more Geryon thought about that, the more he began to understand these bleak-appearing islanders.
The stiff reserve of the gray-cloaked ravens was a face they presented to the world. Behind that face, however, was an altogether different kind of people. The apprentices, for the most part, were blowing the delicate little bottles that were the major item in the trade with the perfume makers of Tol Barun. One apprentice, however, worked alone, fashioning a glass ship cresting a crystal wave. He was a sandy-haired young man with an intent expression. When he looked up from his work and saw Geryon, his eyes widened, but he lowered his head quickly to his work again. Back at the front of the shop, as they were preparing to leave, Geryon asked to look once more at the delicate glass bird perched on its gleaming twig. The piece was so beautiful that it made his heart ache.
"Does it please your majesty?"
It was the young apprentice who had quietly entered the room. He spoke softly.
"I was in the square yesterday, when Brand introduced you to the people," he explained. "I recognized you as soon as I saw you." "And what's your name?"
Geryon asked curiously.
"Joran, your majesty,"
the apprentice replied.
"Do you suppose we could skip those majesties?"
Geryon said rather plaintively.
"I'm not really comfortable with that sort of thing yet. This whole business came as a complete surprise to me."
Joran grinned at him.
"There are all kinds of rumors in the city. They say that you were raised by Belgarath the sorcerer in his tower in the Vale of Aldur. Actually, I was raised in Sindaria by my Aunt Paul, Belgarath's daughter."
"Polgara? The sorceress?"
Joran looked impressed.
"Is she as beautiful as men say she is?"
"Well, I've always thought so."
"Can she really turn herself into a dragon?"
"I suppose she could, if she wanted to,"
Geryon admitted.
"But she prefers the shape of an owl. She loves birds for some reason, and birds go wild at the sight of her. They talk to her all of the time."
"That's an amazing thing,"
Joran marveled.
"I'd give anything to be able to meet her."
He pursed his lips thoughtfully, hesitating a moment.
"Do you think that she would like this little thing?"
he blurted finally, touching the crystal wren.
"Like it?"
Geryon said.
"She'd love it. Would you give it to her for me?"
"Joran?"
Geryon was startled at the idea.
"I couldn't take it. It's too valuable. And I don't have any money to pay you for it."
Joran smiled shyly.
"It's only glass,"
he pointed out.
"And glass is only melted sand. And sand is the cheapest thing in the whole world. If you think she'd like it, I'd really like for her to have it. Would you take it to her for me, please? Tell her it is a gift from Joran the glassmaker."
"I will, Joran,"
Geryon promised, impulsively clasping the young man's hand.
"I'll be proud to carry it to her for you." "I'll wrap it, then," Joran said. "It's not good for glass to go out in the cold from a warm room."
He reached for the piece of velvet and then stopped.
"I'm not being entirely honest with you," he admitted, looking a bit guilty. "The wren is a very good piece, and if the nobles up at the Citadel see it, they might want me to make other things for them. I need a few commissions if I'm ever going to open my own shop, and—"
He glanced once at Torgan's daughter, his heart in his eyes.
"And you can't get married until you've established your own business?"
Geryon suggested.
"Your Majesty will be a very wise king,"
Joran said gravely.
"If I can get past all of the blunders I'll make during the first few weeks,"
Geryon added. Later that afternoon, he delivered the crystal bird to Aunt Paul in her private apartment.
"What's this?"
she asked, taking the cloth-wrapped object.
"It's a present for you, from a young glassmaker I met down in the city,"
Geryon replied.
"He insisted that I give it to you. His name is Joran. Be careful. I think it's kind of fragile."
Aunt Paul gently unwrapped the crystal piece. Her eyes slowly widened as she stared at the exquisitely wrought bird.
"Oh, Geryon,"
she murmured.
"It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen."
"He's awfully good," Geryon told her.
He works for a glassmaker called Torgan, and Torgan says he's a genius. He wants to meet you.
And I want to meet him,
she breathed, her eyes lost in the glowing details of the glass figure. Then she carefully set the crystal Wren down on a table. Her hands were trembling, and her glorious eyes were full of tears.
What's wrong, Aunt Paul?
Geryon asked her, slightly alarmed.
Nothing, Geryon. Nothing at all.
Well, why are you crying, then?
You would never understand, dear, she told him.
Then she put her arms around him and pulled him to her in an almost fierce embrace. The coronation took place at noon the following day. The Hall of the Riven King was full to overflowing with nobles and royalty, and the city below was alive with the sound of bells. Geryon could never actually remember very much of his coronation. He did remember that the ermine-bordered cape was hot and that the plain gold crown the Riven deacon placed on his head was very heavy. What stood out most in his mind was the way the orb of Aldur filled the entire hall with an intense blue light that grew brighter and brighter as he approached the throne, and overwhelmed his ears with that strange, exultant song he always seemed to hear whenever he came near it. The song of the orb was so loud that he scarcely heard the great cheer that greeted him as he turned, robed and crowned, to face the throng in the Hall of the Riven King. He did, however, hear one voice very clearly.
"Hail, Belgarion,"
the voice in his mind said quietly to him. Chapter 13. King Belgarion sat somewhat disconsolately on his throne in the Hall of the Riven King, listening to the endless droning voice of Valgon, the Dolnedran ambassador. It had not been an easy time for Geryon. There were so many things he did not know how to do. For one thing, he was totally incapable of giving orders. For another, he discovered that he had absolutely no time to himself, and that he had not the faintest idea of how to dismiss the servants who continually hovered near him. He was followed wherever he went, and he had even given up trying to catch the overzealous bodyguard or valet or messenger who was always in the passageway behind him. His friends seemed uncomfortable in his presence, and they persisted in calling him Your Majesty, no matter how many times he asked them not to. He did not feel any different, and his mirror told him that he did not look any different. But everyone behaved as if he had changed somehow. The look of relief that passed over their faces each time he left injured him, and he retreated into a kind of protective shell, nursing his loneliness in silence. Aunt Paul stood continually at his side now, but there was a difference there as well. Before, he had always been an adjunct to her, but now it was the other way around, and that seemed profoundly unnatural.
The proposal, if Your Majesty will forgive my saying so, is a most generous, Valgon observed, concluding his reading of the latest treaty offered by Ranborun. The Tolnedran ambassador was a sardonic man with an aquiline nose and an aristocratic bearing. He was a Honthite, a member of that family which had founded the empire, and from which three imperial dynasties had sprung. And he had a scarcely concealed contempt for all Elorns. Valgon was a continual thorn in Geryon's side. Hardly a day passed that some new treaty or trade agreement did not arrive from the Emperor. Geryon had quickly perceived that the Tolnedrans were desperately nervous about the fact that they did not have his signature on a single piece of parchment, and they were proceeding on the theory that if they kept shoving documents in front of a man, eventually he would sign something just to get them to leave him alone. Geryon's counter-strategy was very simple. He refused to sign anything.
It's exactly the same as the one they offered last week, Aunt Paul's voice observed in the silence of his mind. All they did was switch the clauses around and change a few words. Tell him no.
Geryon looked at the smug ambassador with something very close to active dislike.
Totally out of the question, he replied shortly.
Valgun began to protest, but Geryon cut him short. It is identical to last week's proposal, Valgun, and we both know it. The answer was no then, and it is still no. I will not give Tolnedra preferred status in trade with Riva. I will not agree to ask Ranboron's permission before I sign any agreement with any other nation, and I most certainly will not agree to any modification of the terms of the Accords of Vomembre. Please ask Ranboron not to pester me any more until he is ready to talk sense.
Your Majesty, Valgun sounded shocked. One does not speak so to the Emperor of Tolnedra.
I will speak any way I please, Geryon told him. You have my, our permission to leave.
Your Majesty.
You are dismissed, Valgun, Geryon cut him off.
The ambassador drew himself up, bowed coldly, and stalked from the hall.
Not bad,
King Onheg drawled from the partially concealed embrasure where he and the other kings generally gathered. The presence of these royal onlookers made Geryon perpetually uneasy. He knew they were watching his every move, judging, evaluating his decisions, his manner, his words. He knew he was bound to make mistakes during these first few months, and he would have greatly preferred to make them without an audience. But how could he tell a group of sovereign kings that he would prefer not to be the absolute center of their attention?
It's a trifle blunt, though, wouldn't you say? King Thulrak suggested. He'll learn to be more diplomatic in time, King Rhodar predicted. I expect that Ranborun will find this directness refreshing. Just as soon as he recovers from the fit of apoplexy our Belgarian's reply is going to give him.
The assembled kings and nobles all laughed at King Rhodar's sally, and Geryon tried without success to keep from blushing.
Do they have to do that?
He whispered furiously to Aunt Paul. Every time I so much as hiccup, I get all of this commentary.
Don't be surly, dear, she replied calmly. It was a trifle impolite, though. Are you really sure you want to take that tone with your future father-in-law?
That was something of which Geryon most definitely did not wish to be reminded. The Princess Zenedra had still not forgiven him for his sudden elevation, and Geryon was having grave doubts about the whole notion of marrying her. Much as he liked her, and he did like her, he regretfully concluded that Zenedra would not make him a good wife. She was clever and spoiled, and she had a streak of stubbornness in her nature as wide as an ox cart. Geryon was fairly certain that she would take a perverse delight in making his life as miserable as she possibly could. As he sat on his throne, listening to the jocular comments of the Ilorn kings, he began to wish that he had never heard of the orb. As always, the thought of the jewel made him glance up to where it glowed on the pommel of the massive sword hanging above the throne. There was something so irritatingly smug about the way it glowed each time he sat on the throne. It always seemed to be congratulating itself, as if he, Belgarion of Riva, were somehow its own private creation. Geryon did not understand the orb. There was an awareness about it. He knew that. His mind had tentatively touched that awareness and then had carefully retreated. Geryon had been touched on occasions by the minds of gods, but the consciousness of the orb was altogether different. There was a power in it that he could not even begin to comprehend. More than that, its attachment to him seemed quite irrational. Geryon knew himself, and he was painfully aware that he was not that lovable. But each time he came near it, it would begin to glow insufferably, and his mind would fill with that strange soaring song he had first heard in Tuchik's turret. The song of the orb was a kind of compelling invitation. Geryon knew that if he should take it up, its will would join with his, and there would be nothing that between them they could not do. Torak had raised the orb and had cracked the world with it. Geryon knew that if he chose, he could raise the orb and mend that crack.
More alarming was the fact that as soon as the notion occurred to him, the orb began to provide him with precise instructions on how to go about it.
"Pay attention, Geryon," Aunt Paul's voice said to him.
The business of the morning, however, was very nearly completed. There were a few other petitions and a peculiar note of congratulation that had arrived that morning from Nyssa. The tone of the note was tentatively conciliatory, and it appeared over the signature of Tsadi, the eunuch. Geryon decided that he wanted to think things through rather carefully before he drafted a reply. The memory of what had happened in Salmistra's throne room still bothered him, and he was not entirely sure he wanted to normalize relations with the snake people. At least, not just yet. Then, since there was no further court business, he excused himself and left the hall. His robe was very hot, and the crown was beginning to give him a headache. He most definitely wanted to return to his apartment and change clothes. The guards at the side door to the hall bowed respectfully as he passed them and drew up into formation to accompany him.
"I'm not really going any place," Geryon told the sergeant in charge. "Just back to my rooms, and I know the way. Why don't you and your men go have some lunch?"
"Your Majesty's very kind," the sergeant replied. "Will you need us later?"
"I'm not sure. I'll send somebody to let you know."
The sergeant bowed again, and Geryon went on along the dimly lighted corridor. He had found this passageway about 2 days after his coronation. It was relatively unused, and it was the most direct route from the royal apartment to the throne room. Geryon liked it because he could follow it to and from the great hall with a minimum of pomp or ceremony. There were only a few doors, and the candles on the walls were spaced far enough apart to keep the light subdued. The dimness seemed comforting for some reason, almost as if it restored in some measure his anonymity. He walked along, lost in thought. There were so many things to worry about. The impending war between the West and the Angarak kingdoms was uppermost in his mind. He, as overlord of the West, would be expected to lead the West, and Kal'Torak, awakened from his slumber, would come against him with the multitudes of Angarak. How could he possibly face so terrible an adversary? The very name of Torak chilled him. And what did he know about armies and battles? Inevitably, he would blunder, and Torak would smash all of the forces of the West with one mailed fist. Not even sorcery could help him. His own power was still too untried to risk a confrontation with Torak. Aunt Paul would do her best to aid him, of course, but without Belgarath they had little hope of success. And Belgarath had still not given any indication that his collapse had not permanently impaired his abilities. Geryon did not want to think about that anymore. But his other problems were nearly as bad. Very soon he was going to have to come to grips with Tenedra's adamant refusal to make peace. If she would only be reasonable, Geryon was sure that the marginal difference in their rank would not make all that much difference. He liked Tenedra. He was even prepared to admit that his feelings for her went quite a bit deeper than that. She could, usually when she wanted something, be absolutely adorable. If they could just get past this one minor problem, things might turn out rather well. That possibility brightened his thoughts considerably. Musing about it, he continued on down the corridor. He had gone only a few more yards when he heard that furtive step behind him again. He sighed, wishing that his ever-present attendant would find some other amusement. Then he shrugged, and, deep in thought about the Naysan question, he continued on along the corridor. The warning was quite sharp, and came at the last instant.
"Look out!"
the voice in his mind barked at him. Not knowing exactly why, not even actually thinking about it, Geryon reacted instantly, diving headlong to the floor. His crown went rolling as, with a great shower of sparks, a thrown dagger clashed into the stone wall and went bouncing and skittering along the flagstones.
Geryon swore, rolled quickly, and came to his feet with his own dagger in his hand. Outraged and infuriated by this sudden attack, he ran back along the corridor, his ermine-trimmed robe flapping and tangling cumbersomely around his legs. He caught only one or two momentary glimpses of his gray-cloaked attacker as he ran after the knife-thrower. The assassin dodged into a recessed doorway some yards down the corridor, and Geryon heard a heavy door slam behind the fleeing man. When he reached the door and wrenched it open, his dagger still in his fist, he found only another long, dim passageway. There was no one in sight. His hands were shaking, but it was more from anger than from fright. He briefly considered calling the guards, but almost immediately dismissed that idea. To continue following the assailant was, the more he thought about it, even more unwise. He had no weapon but his dagger, and the possibility of meeting someone armed with a sword occurred to him. There might even be more than one involved in this business, and these dimly lighted and deserted corridors were most certainly not a good place for confrontations. As he started to close the door, something caught his eye. A small scrap of gray wool lay on the floor just at the edge of the door frame. Geryon bent, picked it up, and carried it over to one of the candles hanging along the wall. The bit of wool was no more than 2 fingers wide, and seemed to have been torn from the corner of a gray raven cloak. In his haste to escape, the assassin had, Geryon surmised, inadvertently slammed the door on his own cape, and then had ripped off this fragment in his flight. Geryon's eyes narrowed, and he turned and hurried back up the corridor, stooping once to retrieve his crown and again to pick up his assailant's dagger. He looked around once. The hallway was empty and somehow threatening. If the unknown knife-thrower were to return with 3 or 4 companions, things could turn unpleasant. All things considered, it might be best to get back to his own apartments as quickly as possible, and to lock his door. Since there was no one around to witness any lack of dignity, Geryon lifted the skirts of his royal robe and bolted like a rabbit for safety. He reached his own door, jerked it open, and jumped inside, closing and locking it behind him. He stood with his ear against the door, listening for any sounds of pursuit.
"Is there something wrong, Your Majesty?"
Geryon almost jumped out of his skin. He whirled to confront his valet, whose eyes widened as he saw the daggers in the king's hands.
Nothing, he replied quickly, trying to cover his confusion. "Help me out of this thing."
He struggled with the fastenings of his robe. His hands seemed to be full of daggers and crowns. With a negligent flip, he tossed his crown into a nearby chair, sheathed his own dagger, and then carefully laid the other knife and the scrap of wool cloth on the polished table. The valet helped him to remove the robe and then carefully folded it over his arm.
"Would Your Majesty like to have me get rid of these for you?"
he asked, looking a bit distastefully at the dagger and the bit of wool on the table.
"No,"
Geryon told him firmly. Then a thought occurred to him.
"Do you know where my sword is?" "Your Majesty's sword hangs in the throne room,"
the valet replied.
"No, not that one," Geryon said. "The other one. The one I was wearing when I first came here." "I suppose that I could find it,"
the valet answered a bit dubiously.
"Do that," Geryon said. "I think I'd like to have it where I can get my hands on it. And please, see if you can find Laldoran of Wildentor for me. I need to talk to him." "At once, Your Majesty." The valet bowed and quietly left the room.
Geryon took up the dagger and the scrap of cloth and examined both rather closely. The dagger was just a commonplace knife, heavy, sturdily made and with a wire-bound hilt. It bore no ornament or identifying marks of any kind. Its tip was slightly bent, the result of its contact with the stone wall. Whoever had thrown it very hard.
Garion developed a definitely uncomfortable sensation between his shoulder blades. The dagger would probably not be very useful. There were undoubtedly 100 like it in the Citadel. The wool scrap, on the other hand, might prove to be very valuable. Somewhere in this fortress there was a man with the corner of his cloak torn off. The torn cloak and this little piece of cloth would very likely match rather closely. About a half an hour later, Lauldron arrived.
"You sent for me, Garion?" "Sit down, Lauldron,"
Garion told his friend, then pointedly waited until the valet left the room.
"I think I've got a little bit of a problem," he said, sprawling deeper into the chair by the table. "I wondered if I might ask for your help." "You know you don't even have to ask, Garion,"
the earnest young Astorian told him.
"This has to be just between the two of us," Garion cautioned. "I do not want anyone else to know." "My word of honor on it,"
Lauldron replied instantly. Garion slid the dagger across the table to his friend.
"A little while ago, when I was on my way back here, somebody threw this at me."
Lauldron gasped, and his eyes went wide.
"Treason?"
he gasped again.
"Either that or something personal," Garion replied. "I don't know what it's all about." "You must alert your guards,"
Lauldron declared, jumping to his feet.
"No," Garion answered firmly. "If I do that, they'll lock me up entirely. I don't have very much freedom left at all, and I don't want to lose it." "Did you see him at all?"
Lauldron asked, sitting down again and examining the dagger.
"Just his back. He was wearing one of those gray cloaks." "All ravens wear gray cloaks, Garion." "Well, we do have something to work with, though."
Garion took the scrap of wool out from under his tunic.
"After he threw the knife, he ran through a door and slammed it shut behind him. He caught his cloak in the door, and this got ripped off."
Lauldron examined the bit of cloth.
"It looks like a corner," he noted. "That's what I think, too. If we both keep our eyes open, we might just happen to see somebody with the corner of his cloak missing. Then, if we can get our hands on his cloak, we might be able to see if this piece matches."
Lauldron nodded his agreement, his face hardening.
"When we find him, though, I want to deal with him. A king is not supposed to become personally involved in this sort of thing." "I might decide to suspend the rules,"
Garion said grimly.
"I don't like having knives thrown at me. But let's find out who it is first." "I shall start at once,"
Lauldron said, rising quickly.
"I'll examine every corner of every cloak and weaver, if I have to. We will find this traitor, Garion, I promise you."
Garion felt better after that, but it was still a wary young king who, in the company of a detachment of guards, went late that afternoon to the private apartments of the Riven Warder. He looked about constantly as he walked, and his hand was never far from the hilt of the sword at his waist. He found Brand seated before a large harp. The warder's big hands seemed to caress the strings of the instrument, bringing forth a plaintively rippling melody. The big, grim man's face was soft and reflective as he played, and Garion found that the music was even more beautiful because it was so unexpected.
"You play very well, my lord,"
he said respectfully, as the last notes of the song lingered in the strings.
"I play often, your majesty," Brand replied. "Sometimes, as I play, I can even forget that my wife is no longer with me."
He rose from the chair in front of the harp and squared his shoulders, all softness going out of his face.
"How may I serve you, King Balgarion?"
Garion cleared his throat a trifle nervously.
"I'm probably not going to say this very well," he admitted. "But please, take it the way I mean it, not the way it might come out."
"Certainly, Your Majesty."
"I didn't ask for all of this, you know,"
Garion began with a vague gesture that took in the entire citadel.
"The crown, I mean. Being king. All of it. I was really pretty happy the way I was."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
"What I'm trying to get at is, well, You were the ruler here in Reva until I came along.
Brand nodded soberly.
I didn't really want to be king, Garion rushed on, and I certainly did not want to push you out of your position.
Brand looked at him, and then he slowly smiled.
I had wondered why you seemed so uneasy whenever I came into the room, Your Majesty. Is that what's been making you uncomfortable?
Mutely, Garion nodded.
You don't really know us yet, Belgarion, Brand told him. You've only been here for a little more than a month. We are a peculiar sort of people. For over 3,000 years, we have been protecting the orb, ever since Iron Grip came to this island. That's why we exist. And I think that one of the things we have lost along the way is that sense of self other men seem to feel is so important. We serve the orb. That is our only purpose. To be quite honest with you, I'm really rather glad you came when you did. It was getting close to the time when I was supposed to choose my successor. With the help of the orb, of course. But I did not have the faintest idea who I was supposed to choose. Your arrival has relieved me of that task.
We can be friends, then?
I think that we already are, Belgarion, Brand replied gravely. We both serve the same master, and that always brings men closer together.
Garion hesitated.
Am I doing all right?
He blurted. Brand considered that.
Some of the things you have done were not exactly the way I might have done them, but that is to be expected. Rotar and Anheg don't always do the things the same way either. Each of us has his own particular manner.
They make fun of me, don't they? Anheg, Rotar, the others. I hear all of the clever remarks every time I make a decision.
I would not worry too much about that, Belgarion. They're Aelons, and Aelons don't take kings very seriously. They make fun of each other, too, you know. You could almost say that as long as they are joking, everything is all right. If they serious and all, then you will know that you're in trouble.
I suppose I hadn't thought of it that way,
Garion admitted.
You'll get used to it in time, Brand assured him.
Garion felt much better after his conversation with Brand. In the company of his guards, he started back toward the royal apartments. But partway there, he changed his mind and went looking for Aunt Paul instead. When he entered her rooms, his cousin Adara was sitting quietly with her, watching as Aunt Paul carefully mended one of Garion's old tunics. The girl rose and curtsied formally.
"Please, Adara," he said in a pained voice, "don't do that when we are alone. I see enough of it out there."
He gestured in the direction of the more public parts of the building.
"Whatever your majesty wishes," she replied.
"And don't call me that. I'm still just Garion." She looked gravely at him with her calm, beautiful eyes.
"No, cousin," she disagreed. "You will never be just Garion any more."
He sighed as the truth of that struck his heart.
"If you would excuse me," she said then, "I must go attend Queen Selar. She is a bit unwell, and she says it comforts her to have me near."
"It comforts all of us when you are near," Garion told her, without even thinking about it. She smiled at him fondly.
"There might be some hope for him after all,"
Aunt Paul observed, her needle busy. Adara looked at Garion.
"He's never really been that bad, Lady Polgara."
She inclined her head toward them both and quietly left the room. Garion wandered around for a few moments and then flung himself into a chair. A great deal had happened that day, and he felt suddenly at odds with the whole world. Aunt Paul continued to sew.
"Why are you doing that?"
Garion demanded finally.
"I'll never wear that old thing again."
"It needs fixing, dear," she told him placidly.
"There are 100 people around who could do it for you. I prefer to do it myself. Put it down and talk to me.
She set the tunic aside and looked at him inquiringly.
And what did your majesty wish to discuss?
Aunt Paul, Geryon's voice was stricken, not you too.
Don't give orders then, dear, she recommended,
picking up the tunic again. Geryon watched her at her sewing for a few moments, not really knowing what to say. A strange thought occurred to him.
Why are you doing that, Aunt Paul?
He asked, really curious this time.
Probably no one will ever use it again, so you're just wasting time on it. It is my time, dear, she reminded him.
She looked up from her sewing, her eyes unreadable. Then, without explanation, she held up the tunic with one hand and ran the forefinger of her other hand carefully up the rip. Geryon felt a very light surge, and the sound was only a whisper. The rip mended itself before his eyes, rewoven as if it had never existed.
Now you can see how completely useless mending really is, she told him. Why do you do it, then? Because I like to sew, dear, she replied.
With a sharp little jerk, she ripped the tunic again. Then she picked up her needle and patiently began repairing the rip.
Sewing keeps the hands and eyes busy, but leaves the mind free for other things. It's very relaxing. Sometimes you're awfully complicated, Aunt Paul.
Yes, dear, I know. Geryon paced about for a bit, then suddenly knelt beside her chair, and pushing her sewing aside, he put his head into her lap.
Oh, Aunt Paul, he said, very close to tears. What's the matter, dear?
She gasped, carefully smoothing his hair.
I'm so lonely. Is that all?
He lifted his head and stared at her incredulously. He had not expected that.
Everyone's lonely, dear, she explained, drawing him close to her. We touch other people only briefly. Then we are alone again. You will get used to it in time. Nobody will talk to me now. Not the way they did before. They're always bowing and saying, Your Majesty, to me. You are the king, after all. But I don't want to be. That's too bad. It is the destiny of your family, so there is not a thing that you can do about it. Did anyone ever tell you about Prince Gerard? I don't think so. Who was he? He was the only survivor when the Naesan assassins killed King Gorik and his family. He escaped by throwing himself into the sea. How old was he? 6. He was a very brave child. Everyone thought that he had drowned, and that his body had been washed out to sea. Your grandfather and I encouraged that belief. For 1,300 years, we have hidden Prince Gerard's descendants. For generations, they've lived out their lives in quiet obscurity for the single purpose of bringing you to the throne. And now you say that you don't want to be king? I don't know any of those people, he said. He knew he was behaving badly, but he could not seem to help himself. Would it help if you did know them? Some of them, anyway.
The question baffled him.
Perhaps it might, she decided.
She laid her sewing aside and stood up, drawing him to his feet.
Come with me, she told him,
and led him to the tall window that looked out over the city below. There was a small balcony outside. In one corner, where a rain gutter had cracked, there had built up during the fall and winter a sheet of shiny black ice, curving down over the railing and spreading out on the balcony floor. Aunt Paul unlatched the window, and it swung open, admitting a blast of icy air that made the candles dance.
"Look directly into the ice, Geryon," she told him, pointing at the glittering blackness. "Look deep into it."
He did as she told him, and felt the force of her mind at work. Something was in the ice, shapeless at first, but emerging slowly, and becoming more and more visible.
It was, he saw, finally, the figure of a pale blonde woman, quite lovely, and with a warm smile on her lips. She seemed young, and her eyes were directly on Geryon's face.
"My baby,"
a voice seemed to whisper to him.
"My little Geryon."
Geryon began to tremble violently.
"Mother?"
he gasped.
"So tall now,"
the whisper continued.
"Almost a man."
"And already a king, Ildara,"
Aunt Paul told the phantom in a gentle voice.
"Then he was the chosen one,"
the ghost of Geryon's mother exulted.
"I knew it. I could feel it when I carried him under my heart."
A second shape had begun to appear beside the first. It was a tall young man, with dark hair, but a strangely familiar face. Geryon clearly saw its resemblance to his own.
"Hail, Belgerion, my son," the second shape said to him.
"Father?"
Geryon replied, not knowing what else to say.
"Our blessings, Geryon,"
the second ghost said, as the two figures started to fade.
"I avenged you, father,"
Geryon called after them. It seemed important that they know that. He was never sure, however, if they had heard him. Aunt Paul was leaning against the window frame with a look of exhaustion on her face.
"Are you all right?"
Geryon asked her, concerned.
"It is a very difficult thing to do, dear," she told him, passing a weary hand over her face.
But there was yet another flicker within the depths of the ice, and the familiar shape of the blue wolf appeared, the one who had joined Belgarath in the fight with Grol the Eldrak in the mountains of Ulgo. The wolf sat looking at them for a moment, then flickered briefly into the shape of a snowy owl, and, finally, became a tawny-haired woman with golden eyes. Her face was so like Aunt Paul's that Geryon could not help glancing quickly back and forth to compare them.
"You left it open, Balgara,"
the golden-eyed woman said gently. Her voice was as warm and soft as a summer evening.
"Yes, mother,"
Aunt Paul replied.
"I'll close it in a moment." "It's all right, Balgara,"
the wolf woman told her daughter.
"It gave me the chance to meet him."
She looked directly into Geryon's face.
"A touch or two is still there,"
she observed.
"A bit about the eyes, and in the shape of the jaw. Does he know?"
"Not everything, mother."
Perhaps that is as well,"
Poledra noted. Once again another figure emerged out of the dark depths of the ice. The second woman had hair like sunlight, and her face was even more like Aunt Paul's than Poledra's.
"Balgara, my dear sister,"
she said.
"Beldoran?"
Aunt Paul responded in a voice overwhelmed with love.
"And Belgerion,"
Geryon's ultimate grandmother said.
"The final flower of my love and Riva's." "Our blessings also, Belgerion,"
Poledra declared.
"Farewell, for now. But know that we love thee."
And then the two were gone.
"Does that help?"
Aunt Paul asked him, her voice deep with emotion and her eyes filled with tears. Geryon was too stunned by what he had just seen and heard to answer. Dumbly, he nodded.
"I'm glad the effort was not wasted then," she said. "Please, close the window, dear. It's letting the winter in."
Chapter 14. It was the first day of spring, and King Belgerion of Riva was terribly nervous. He had watched the approach of Princess Tenedra's 16th birthday with a steadily mounting anxiety, and now that the day had finally arrived, he hovered on the very edge of panic. The deep blue brocade doublet over which a half-dozen tailors had labored for weeks
still did not seem to feel just right. Somehow it was a bit tight across the shoulders, and the stiff collar scratched his neck. Moreover, his gold crown seemed unusually heavy on this particular day, and as he fidgeted, his throne seemed even more uncomfortable than usual. The Hall of the Raven King had been decorated extensively for the occasion, but even the banners and garlands of pale spring flowers could not mask the ominous starkness of the great throne room. The assembled notables, however, chatted and laughed among themselves, as if nothing significant were taking place. Geryon felt rather bitter about their heartless lack of concern in the face of what was about to happen to him. Aunt Paul stood at the left side of his throne, garbed in a new silver gown, and with a silver circlet about her hair. Belgarath lounged indolently on the right, wearing a new green doublet, which had already become rumpled.
"Don't squirm so much, dear," Aunt Paul told Geryon calmly. "That's easy enough for you to say,"
Geryon retorted.
"Try not to think about it," Belgarath advised. "It will all be over in a little while."
Then Brand, his face seeming even more bleak than usual, entered the hall from the side door and came to the dais.
"There's a Nyssen at the gate of the citadel, Your Majesty," he said quietly. "He says that he is an emissary of Queen Salmistra, and that he is here to witness the ceremony."
"Isn't that impossible?"
Geryon asked Aunt Paul, startled by the warder's surprising announcement.
"Not entirely," she replied. "More likely, though, it is a diplomatic fiction. I would imagine that the Nyssens would prefer to keep Salmistra's condition a secret." "Well, what do I do?"
Belgarath shrugged.
"Let him in." "In here?"
Bran's voice was shocked.
"A Nyssen in the throne room? Belgarath, you are not serious." "Geryon is overlord of the West, Brand," the old man replied. "And that includes Nyssa. I do not imagine that the Snake people will be much use to us at any time, but let's be polite to them at least."
Brand's face went stiff with disapproval.
"What is Your Majesty's decision?"
he asked Geryon directly.
"Well," Geryon hesitated. "Let him come in, I guess." "Don't vacillate, Geryon,"
Aunt Paul told him.
"I'm sorry," Geryon said quickly. "And don't apologize. Kings do not apologize."
He looked at her helplessly, and then turned back toward Brand.
"Tell the emissary from Nyssa to join us," he said, though his tone, at least he thought, was placating.
"By the way, Brand," Belgarath suggested, "I would not let anyone get too excited about this. The Nyssen has ambassadorial status, and it would be a serious breach of protocol if he died unexpectedly."
Brand bowed rather stiffly, turned, and left the hall.
"Was that really necessary, Father?"
Aunt Paul asked.
"Old grudges die hard, Paul,"
Belgarath replied.
"Sometimes it is best to get everything right out in front, so that there are not any misunderstandings later."
When the emissary of the Snake Queen entered the hall, Geryon started with surprise. It was Tzedi, the chief eunuch in Salmistra's palace. The thin man with the dead-looking eyes and shaved head wore the customary iridescent blue-green Nyssen robe, and he bowed sinuously as he approached the throne.
"Greetings to His Majesty, Belgarion of Reva, from eternal Salmistra, Queen of the Snake People," he intoned.
"Welcome, Tzedi,"
Geryon replied formally.
"My queen sends her regards on this happy day,"
Tzedi continued.
"She didn't really, did she?" Geryon asked a bit pointedly.
"Not precisely, Your Majesty,"
Sadie admitted, without the least trace of embarrassment.
"I'm sure she would have, however, if we'd been able to make her understand what was happening."
"How is she?" Geryon remembered the dreadful transformation Salnistra had undergone.
"Difficult," Sadie answered blandly. "Of course, that's nothing new. Fortunately, she sleeps for a week or two after she's been fed. She molted last month, and it made her dreadfully short-tempered."
He rolled his eyes ceilingward.
"It was ghastly," he murmured. "She bit three servants before it was over. They all died immediately, of course."
"She's venomous?"
Geryon was a bit startled at that.
"She has always been venomous, Your Majesty."
"Oh, that's not the way I mean."
"Forgive my little joke," Sadie apologized. "Judging from the reactions of people she has bitten, I'd guess that she's at least 10 times more deadly than a common cobra."
"Is she terribly unhappy?"
Geryon felt a strange pity for the hideously altered queen.
"That's really rather hard to say, Your Majesty," Sadie replied clinically. "It is difficult to tell what a snake's really feeling, you understand. By the time she learned to communicate her wishes to us, she seemed to have become reconciled to her new form. We feed her and keep her clean. As long as she has her mirror and someone to bite, when she's feeling peevish, she seems quite content."
"She still looks at herself in the mirror? I wouldn't think she'd want to now."
"Our race has a somewhat different view of the serpent, Your Majesty," Sadie explained. "We find it a rather attractive creature, and our queen is a splendid-looking snake, after all. Her new skin is quite lovely, and she seems very proud of it."
He turned and bowed deeply to Aunt Paul.
"Lady Polgara," he greeted her.
"Sadie," she acknowledged with a brief nod.
"May I convey to you the heartfelt thanks of Her Majesty's government?"
One of Aunt Paul's eyebrows rose inquiringly.
"The government, my lady, not the queen herself. Your, intervention, shall we say, has simplified things in the palace enormously. We no longer have to worry about Salmisra's whims and peculiar appetites. We rule by committee, and we hardly ever find it necessary to poison each other any more. No one has tried to poison me for months. It is all very smooth and civilized in Stithistor now."
He glanced briefly at Geryon.
"May I also offer my congratulations on your success with His Majesty? He seems to have matured considerably. He really was very callow when last we met."
"Whatever happened to Isis?"
Geryon asked him, ignoring that particular observation. Sadie shrugged.
"Isis? Oh, he's still about, scratching out a living as a paid assassin, probably. I imagine that one day we will find him floating face down in the river. It is the sort of end one expects for someone like that."
There was a sudden blare of trumpets from just beyond the great doors at the back of the hall. Geryon started nervously, and his mouth quite suddenly went dry. The heavy doors swung open, and a double file of Tolnedran legionnaires marched in, their breastplates burnished until they shone like mirrors, the tall crimson plumes on their helmets waving as they marched. The inclusion of the legionnaires in the ceremony had infuriated Brand. The Raven Warder had stalked about in icy silence for days after he had discovered that Geryon had granted Ambassador Valgon's request for a proper escort for Princess Tenedra. Brand did not like Tolnedrans, and he had been looking forward to witnessing the pride of the Empire humbled by Tenedra's forlorn and solitary entrance into the hall. The presence of the legionnaires spoiled that, of course, and Brand's disappointment and disapproval had been painfully obvious. As much as Geryon wanted to stay on Brand's good side, however, he did not intend to start off the official relationship between his bride-to-be and himself by publicly humiliating her. Geryon was quite ready to acknowledge his lack of education, but he was not prepared to admit to being that stupid. When Tenedra entered, her hand resting lightly on Valgon's arm, she was every inch an imperial princess. Geryon could only gape at her. Although the accords of Vomimbre required that she present herself in her wedding gown, Geryon was totally unprepared for such imperial magnificence. Her gown was of gold and white brocade covered with seed pearls, and its train swept the floor behind her. Her flaming hair was intricately curled and cascaded over her left shoulder like a deep crimson waterfall. Her circlet of tinted gold held in place a short veil that did not so much conceal her face as soften it into luminousness. She was tiny and perfect, exquisite beyond belief, but her eyes were like little green agates. She and Valgon moved at a stately pace down between the ranks of her tall, burnished legionnaires. When they reached the front of the hall, they stopped. Brand, sober-faced and imposing, took his staff of office from Braylon, his eldest son, and rapped sharply on the stone floor with its butt 3 times.
Her Imperial Highness, Tenedra, of the Tolnedran Empire, he announced in a deep, booming voice. Will your majesty grant her audience?
I will receive the princess, Geryon declared, straightening a bit on his throne.
The Princess Tenedra may approach the throne, Brand proclaimed.
Though his words were ritual formality, they had obviously been chosen with great care to make it absolutely clear that Imperial Tolnedra came to the hall of the Raven King as a suppliant. Tenedra's eyes flashed fire, and Geryon groaned inwardly. The little princess, however, glided to the appointed spot before the dais and curtsied regally. There was no submission in her gesture.
"The princess has permission to speak," Brand boomed.
For a brief, irrational moment, Geryon wanted to strangle him. Tenedra drew herself up, her face as cold as a winter sea.
"Thus I, Tenedra, daughter to Ranborun the 23rd, and princess of Imperial Tolnedra, present myself as required by treaty and law, in the presence of His Majesty, Belgerian of Riva," she declared. "And thus has the Tolnedran Empire once more demonstrated her willingness to fulfill her obligations as set forth in the Accords of Vomimbre. Let other kingdoms witness Tolnedra's meticulous response and follow her example in meeting their obligations. I declare before these witnesses that I am an unmarried virgin of a suitable age. Will His Majesty consent to take me to wife?"
Geryon's reply had been carefully thought out.
The quiet inner voice had suggested a way to head off years of marital discord. He rose to his feet and said,
I, Belgarion, King of Riva, hereby consent to take Imperial Princess Tenedra to be my wife and queen. I declare, moreover, that she will rule jointly by my side in Riva, and wheresoever else the authority of our throne may extend.
The gasp that rippled through the hall was clearly audible, and Bran's face went absolutely white. The look Tenedra gave Geryon was quizzical, and her eyes softened slightly.
"Your Majesty is too kind,"
she responded with a graceful little curtsy. Some of the edge had gone out of her voice, and she threw a quick sidelong glance at the spluttering Bran.
"Have I your Majesty's permission to withdraw?"
she asked sweetly.
"As your Highness wishes," Geryon replied, sinking back down onto his throne. He was perspiring heavily.
The princess curtsied again, with a mischievous little twinkle in her eyes, then turned and left the hall with her legionnaires drawn up in close order about her. As the great doors boomed shut behind her, an angry buzz ran through the crowd. The word outrageous seemed to be the most frequently repeated.
"This is unheard of, Your Majesty," Brand protested.
"Not entirely,"
Geryon replied defensively.
"The throne of Arendia is held jointly by King Corodulin and Queen Maeserina."
He looked to Mandorolin, gleaming in his armor, with a mute appeal in his eyes.
"His Majesty speaks truly, my Lord Brand," Mandorolin declared. "I assure thee that our kingdom suffers not from the lack of singularity upon the throne." "That is Arendia," Brand objected. "This is Riva. The situations are entirely different. No Aelon kingdom has ever been ruled by a woman."
"It might not hurt to examine the possible advantages of the situation," King Rhodar suggested. "My own queen, for example, plays a somewhat more significant role in Drasnian affairs than custom strictly allows."
With great difficulty, Brand regained at least some of his composure.
"May I withdraw, Your Majesty?"
he asked, his face still livid.
"If you wish,"
Geryon answered quietly. It was not going well. Bran's conservatism was the one stumbling block he had not considered.
"It is an interesting notion, dear," Aunt Paul said quietly to him. "But don't you think it might have been better to consult with someone before you made it a public declaration? Won't it help to cement relations with the Tolnedrans?" "Oh, quite possibly," she admitted. "I am not saying that it is a bad idea, Geryon. I just think it might have been better to warn a few people first. What are you laughing at?" she demanded of Belgoroth, who was leaning against the throne, convulsed with mirth.
"The bear cult is going to have collective apoplexy," he chortled.
Her eyes widened slightly.
"Oh, dear, I had forgotten about them. They're not going to like it very much, are they?"
Geryon concluded.
"Particularly since Tenedra is a Tolnedran."
"I think that you can count on them to go up in flames," the old sorcerer replied, still laughing.
In the days that followed, the usually bleak halls of the Citadel were filled with color as official visitors and representatives teemed through them, chatting, gossiping, and conducting business in out-of-the-way corners. The rich and varied gifts they had brought to celebrate the occasion filled several tables lining one of the walls in the great throne room. Geryon, however, was unable to visit or to examine the gifts. He spent his days in a room with his advisors and with the Tolnedran ambassador and his staff, as the details of the official betrothal document were hammered out. Valgon had seized on Geryon's break with tradition, and was trying to wring the last measure of advantage from it, while Brand was desperately trying to add clauses and stipulations to rigidly circumscribe Tenedra's authority. As the two haggled back and forth, Geryon found himself more and more frequently staring out the window. The sky over Riva was an intense blue, and puffy white clouds ran before the wind. The bleak crags of the island were touched with the first green blush of spring. Faintly, carried by the wind, the high, clear voice of a shepherdess, singing to her flock, wafted through the open window. There was a pure, unschooled quality to her voice, and she sang with no hint of self-consciousness, as if there were not a human ear within 100 leagues. Geryon sighed as the last notes of her song died away, and then returned his attention to the tedious negotiations. His attention, however, was divided in those early days of spring. Since he was unable to pursue the search for the man with the torn cloak himself, he was forced to rely on Lalderan to press the investigation. Lalderan was not always entirely reliable, and the search for the would-be assassin seemed to fire the enthusiastic young Asturian's imagination. He crept about the citadel with dark, sidelong glances, and reported his lack of findings in conspiratorial whispers. Turning things over to Lalderan might have been a mistake, but there had been no real choice in the matter. Any of Geryon's other friends would have immediately raised a general outcry, and the entire affair would have been irrevocably out in the open. Geryon did not want that. He was not prepared to make any decisions about the assassin until he found out who had thrown the knife, and why. Too many other things could have been involved. Only Lalderan could be relied upon for absolute secrecy, even though there was some danger in turning him loose in the Citadel with a license to track someone down. Lalderan had a way of turning simple things into catastrophes, and Geryon worried almost as much about that as he did about the possibility of another knife hurtling out of the shadows toward his unprotected back. Among the visitors present for the betrothal ceremonies was Senedra's cousin Zira, who was present as the personal representative of Queen Xantha. Though shy at first, the dryad soon lost her reserve, particularly when she found herself the center of the attention of a cluster of smitten young noblemen. The gift of Queen Xantha to the royal couple was, Geryon thought, somewhat peculiar. Wrapped in plain leaves, Zira presented them with 2 sprouted acorns. Senedra, however, seemed delighted. She insisted upon planting the 2 seeds immediately and rushed down to the small private garden adjoining the royal apartments.
"It's very nice, I suppose," Geryon commented dubiously as he stood watching his princess on her knees in the damp loam of the garden, busily preparing the earth to receive Queen Xantha's gift. Senedra looked at him sharply.
"I don't believe your majesty understands the significance of the gift," she said, in that hatefully formal tone she had assumed with him.
"Stop that," Geryon told her crossly. "I still have a name, after all, and I am almost positive that you haven't forgotten it."
"If your majesty insists," she replied loftily.
"My majesty does. What's so significant about a couple of nuts?"
She looked at him almost pityingly.
"You wouldn't understand."
"Not if you won't take the trouble to explain it to me."
"Oh, very well,"
she sounded irritatingly superior.
"The 1 acorn is from my very own tree. The other is from Queen Xantha's."
"So?"
"See how impossibly dense he is?"
the princess said to her cousin.
"He is not a dryad, Senedra,"
Zira replied calmly.
"Obviously."
Zira turned to Geryon.
"The acorns are not really from my mother," she explained. "The gifts
are from the trees themselves.
Well, why didn't you tell me that in the first place? Geryon demanded of Tenedra. She sniffed and returned to her digging.
While they are still just young shoots, Tenedra will bind them together,
Zira went on.
These shoots will intertwine as they grow, embracing each other, and forming a single tree. It is the dryad symbol for marriage. The two will become one, just as you and Tenedra will. That remains to be seen,
Tenedra sniffed, trowling busily in the dirt. Geryon sighed.
I hope the trees are patient. Trees are very patient, Geryon,
Zira replied. She made a little gesture that Tenedra could not see, and Geryon followed her to the other end of the garden.
She does love you, you know,
Zira told him quietly.
Oh, she won't admit it, of course. But she loves you. I know her well enough to see that. Why is she acting the way she is, then? She does not like being forced into things, that's all. But I'm not the one who's forcing her. Why take it out on me? Can you think of anyone else that she can take it out on?
Geryon hadn't thought of that. He left the garden quietly. Zira's words gave him some hope that one of his problems, at least, might eventually be resolved. Tenedra would pout and storm for a while, and then, after she had made him suffer enough, she would relent. Perhaps it might speed things along if he suffered a bit more, obviously. The other problems had not changed significantly. He was still going to have to lead an army against Khal Torak. Belgareth had still given no sign that his power was intact, and someone in the Citadel was still, so far as Geryon knew, sharpening another knife, just for him. He sighed and went back to his own rooms, where he could worry in private. Somewhat later, he received word that Aunt Paul wanted to see him in her private apartments. He went immediately and found her seated by the fire, sewing as usual. Belgareth, dressed in his shabby old clothes, sat in one of the deep, comfortable chairs on the other side of the fire with his feet up and a tankard in his hand.
"You wanted to see me, Aunt Paul?"
Geryon inquired as he entered.
"Yes, dear. Sit down."
She looked at him somewhat critically.
"He still doesn't look much like a king, does he, father?"
Give him time, Paul," the old man told her. "He hasn't been at it for very long."
"You both knew all along, didn't you?"
Geryon accused them.
"Who I was, I mean."
"Naturally," Aunt Paul answered in that maddening way of hers.
"Well, if you had wanted me to behave like a king, you should have told me about it. That way, I'd have had some time to get used to the idea."
"It seems to me we discussed this once before," Belgareth mentioned. "A long time ago. If you will stop and think a bit, I am sure you'll be able to see why we had to keep it a secret."
"Maybe,"
Geryon said it a bit doubtfully.
"All this has happened too fast, though. I hadn't even got used to being a sorcerer yet, and now I have to be a king, too. It's all got me off balance."
"You're adaptable, Geryon," Aunt Paul told him, her needle flickering.
"You had better give him the amulet, Paul," Belgareth mentioned. "The princess should be here soon."
"I was just about to, father," she replied, laying aside her sewing. "And what's this?"
Geryon asked.
"The princess has a gift for you," Aunt Paul said. "A ring. It is a bit ostentatious, but act suitably pleased.